2 million people have now fled Syria as refugees. 1 million of those are children. Children. Many millions are displaced within Syria itself. Numbers are really hard to get our head around on this one, but when each of those millions of lives, not unlike our own, with aspirations and hopes and passions, bellies to fill, lives to live, that can bring it right home, I think. In the city of Damascus, food is now in such short supply that this week Muslim clerics issued fatwas allowing the city's starving population to eat dogs, cats, and donkeys. My next guest has worked in war zones as a doctor for the last 15 years or so. She says Syria is the worst she's seen. She says doctors, hospitals, ambulances, and patients are being directly and explicitly targeted in the most horrific ways, contravening, as we know, international humanitarian law. Australian paediatrician and humanitarian Dr. Annie Sparrow is Assistant Professor of Global Health and Director of the Human Rights Program at Icahn School, at the Icahn School of Medicine in New York. She's spent time in refugee camps on the Syrian-Turkish border and other areas, and she joins me on the line now from New York. Welcome, Annie.
Thanks very much, Natasha.
What did you witness on those camps, in those camps on the Syrian-Turkish border recently?
One of the most striking things is the level of war trauma. And I say that having sort of worked around my way around the global block a few times now in the last 15 years or so, you see so many disabilities, amputations, so many men, women, children with paralysis, and not just fighters, of course, but the women and children as young as five that have paraplegia and lost their limbs and their function because of the shrapnel or because of gunshot wounds. And that's a very significant piece of this crisis and speaks to the fact that populations, whole populations, have been deliberately targeted, particularly in places where the government has lost control of towns and villages.
Mm.
That's a huge piece.
Mm. You have become very active, as have many of your doctor colleagues, on the situation for healthcare professionals and healthcare facilities in Syria. Can you describe for us what the state of health and healthcare in Syria on the ground is at present?
I want to say that it's so much more disturbing than I even anticipated 4 months ago before I actually went to the borders, the border regions of both Lebanon and Turkey. Because having worked in Africa for years now, as I have, you expect to see malnutrition and diarrheal disease, those types of things that are classic of refugee health. We didn't expect to see it in Syria. It was a middle-income country with quite a sophisticated healthcare system. And what we're seeing is the spiraling of Syria, the transformation into what looks a whole lot more like, honestly, it looks more like 19th century Britain must have done with the rise of infectious disease, the outbreaks of measles, of typhoid, of tuberculosis, of hepatitis, of all these types of vaccine-preventable diseases, and against this backdrop of malnutrition, which, of course, is being used as another weapon of war by depriving whole areas, neighbourhoods, suburbs, towns of food, by the denial of relief to these particular areas which are held by rebels or held by the opposition.
People aren't able to get just basic medicines now, I gather. What is particularly chilling in this conflict, I gather, and you've written very viscerally about this, is that doctors are being targeted themselves. What have colleagues told you, the people that you've met and spoken to in recent months?
It is particularly shocking and perhaps the most chilling part of this whole conflict because medical neutrality is absolutely fundamental to how you operate in war, and that's what I myself rely on when I work in war zones. The only way you can do your job is because we are protected under the laws of war, because the necessity is to actually deliver aid to people who need it, and instead doctors are deliberately targeted. And if they are perceived to help not just the opposition, but frankly, civilians in general, anyone who is not actively pro-regime, they are now charged and criminalized as terrorists and treated as such. So doctors have been disappeared. I spoke to many doctors who've been held in detention, tortured, prevented from doing their jobs and forced to flee the country. And worse still, once they're charged as a terrorist, even if they have left, then revenge can be taken out by executing or detaining members of their own family. Which is a very, very severe and harsh penalty. So you have that piece, and you have the fact that hospitals are bombed or destroyed. There are ones that are actually taken over and used as military bases for the conduct of hostilities, and what that means is that there are tanks parked outside, there are armoured personnel carriers in the grounds, there are snipers on the rooftops that actually shoot people who want to come as patients. So, you know, we used to call it elective surgery when people would come in for hip replacement or removal of varicose veins or cosmetic surgery, and now people elect not to have surgery because it's too dangerous to actually go to hospital anymore.
And ambulances themselves have been targeted as well, haven't they, as they've been trying to get people out of situations and into what hospitals are there.
It's just unbelievable. When you hear about it, it's one thing. But then when you go and you talk to the people and you see the ambulances that have been, you know, just literally sort of gunned down by machine guns with bullets everywhere, and you meet the people who have been hideously injured, you know, and still paralyzed, and of course they've lost colleagues. And it comes back down to that violation of that very fundamental basis, which forms the whole premise of the laws of war. You don't attack ambulances, doctors, nurses, any kind of medical personnel or facilities, because that's what the laws of war are there for.
This is this concept, more than a concept, is absolutely vital, isn't it, of medical neutrality. And in this conflict, that has been totally denied, in fact, actively. You write in a powerful way that doctors, in being called terrorists, in being targeted as they are, that their ability to heal is being recast as a weapon.
Yes. I didn't believe that when I first heard it. You know, I didn't really, you think, oh, yes. And the same way that you don't really believe that some of the fighters are deliberately shot in the spine in order to produce paralysis rather than death, because it's far more humiliating, isn't it, to have a lifetime of disability. You can't walk, you can't pee, you can't fight, you can't look after your family, etc. I mean, you think these are tales of war or sensationalism. But it's true, you know, doctors are seen as more powerful as weapons, and that's why they have been so targeted, and why the population of, you know, so many doctors have simply left the country, and so many others have been disappeared into these, you know, detention centres of torture and interrogation, and we don't even know where they are.
There's also been, there are also diseases that, and you mentioned this before in terms of diseases that you can vaccinate against that are being, that young people and family, everyone's being afflicted with now. But there are diseases that you rarely see, a particularly nasty parasitic disease.
That's what really shocked me. And, you know, think about it in Perth when I'm a medical student and you learn about these diseases, in particular leishmaniasis. It's just one of those things that you learn at the end of a list, you know, you never expect to see it. And then I saw it in Afghanistan, you know, a long time ago, at the end of the 90s or 2000, you see these little girls and boys with horrible facial scarring. And I realized, oh, that's leishmaniasis. And then actually, Natasha, I saw it again in Woomera in the detention centres when I would see, you know, asylum seekers from Afghanistan, also with leishmaniasis. And then I see it in Somalia. But here's the thing. It's a real disease of war because it's spread by a sandfly, which can only jump around the ground. It's not like mosquitoes, which breed in disasters, and they're frankly indifferent to war. It's something you see whether there's a war or a natural disaster. But when you bomb a city like Afghanistan, like New York, you know, like Damascus, like Aleppo, where people live in tall apartment buildings, you literally bring the population down to the ground, and that's where the sandflies live. And at the same time, the destruction of healthcare means there's no treatment, there's no medications, And there's no public health, so there's no trash pickup. Oh, I just said trash, that's such an American word. There's no garbage collection, you know, nothing gets picked up anymore. And so you get these huge piles of rubbish, and you get this population which now lives at ground level. Houses have been bombed to bits, and they live in tents and shelters in trees. And so the sandfly bites them, and you suddenly see this absolute sort of escalation epidemic of this hideous disease of war.
Dr. Annie Sparrow is joining me from New York this morning on Life Matters. She's an Australian paediatrician and humanitarian. She has been working around the world in some of the truly horrific war crises, and most recently she has become very active on the crisis in Syria. Annie, you have launched a population-level study where you're conducting hundreds of interviews, I gather, along the border regions of Lebanon and Turkey. What specifically are you asking people, and who are you asking, and what are you finding out?
What we're trying to do is really to quantify civilian suffering. And that's because, you know, wars happen, that's reality. But if you conduct your war according to the rules of war, which means don't target doctors, nurses, health personnel, protect ambulances, facilities. The whole point of the laws of war are to limit the effects on civilians. So when you do that well, it's called collateral damage, you know, when people accidentally die. What we don't know is what we call it when people are targeted on such a massive scale. And in Syria, where they did have a, you know, extraordinary healthcare system, then the effects are very, you know, we can actually quantify it because we know what the healthcare system looked like before. We know what the maternal health looked like. We know what that people actually had diseases of diabetes and heart disease and hypertension and stroke and asthma and allergies. And Syria had made what we call that epidemiological transition where you don't die of infectious diseases, but you die of those diseases, you know, the similar ones to Australia, exactly the same. So now, you know, we see, we can actually compare what Syria was like two and a half years ago to what we're seeing now with the infectious diseases, which include the vaccine-preventable ones like measles, mumps, rubella, like hepatitis, and then with the escalation of leishmaniasis with tuberculosis, things that were very rare before. And instead of the people dying of diabetes and kidney failure as they did before, they're dying of gunshot wounds, shelling, shrapnel. We're seeing these terrible disabilities, you know, the amputations, which also reflect the fact that because hospitals have been so, you know, because the hospitals have been destroyed, that people have to seek care in what they call field hospitals, which frankly I also thought sounded like something like a MSF, like a Doctors Without Borders hospital. But it doesn't look anything like a field hospital. It looks a lot more like a field than a hospital. It's just like a table with a torchlight, and surgeons are doing their best to operate on patients who have received these horrific blast injuries and got shrapnel and ordnance all over their bodies. And how can they do anything except just try and stitch it up? And they have to literally take blood out of themselves to give it to their patients.
And this is what's happening.
In order to keep them alive. And that's what's happening.
This is what's happening. So you, along with around 50 other doctors, signed an open letter, which was published in the leading medical journal, The Lancet, recently, warning that Syria's healthcare system is at breaking point. I'd say it sounds more beyond breaking point now.
Yes.
What was in that letter? What particularly did you say? And who did you want to read it? And have they read it?
Yes, I would say that, yes, we got, you know, in the space of a few days, actually, we got maybe over 6.3 million people to read it through the extraordinary advances in social media. Then, yes, we know that 6.3 million people did read it. And that was followed by this letter, a joint article by 27 foreign ministers, including the Egyptian foreign minister, to call on the Syrian regime to also protect civilians and medical personnel. And then Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, got up at the General Assembly 2 weeks ago to say, I call on the Syrian government to uphold the obligations under international humanitarian law and to lift the obstacles to humanitarian access and stop attacking doctors, basically. So in that sense, it was extraordinarily effective.
Has it been effective enough, though, Annie?
Well, you know, the end result of that too was that the UN Security Council released what's called a presidential statement saying you must allow aid to come across the borders, because at the moment, you know, UNHCR is in Damascus, but all the government controls the distribution of aid, and you can imagine that since the government is actually attacking its own people, then it actually isn't impartial in the distribution of aid, which is why we are seeing people starving to death in Damascus and forced to eat cats and donkeys. So is it being effective? At this point, no. We are very much hoping that since Russia signed that letter, that Russia and Putin will also put pressure on Assad to open the borders and to allow the widespread distribution of aid and to stop attacking doctors. You're right, the health system is broken. And the fact that doctors are charged as terrorists for doing their job, it just speaks to the way that it's not even a careless, you know, this is not some careless oversight of law. It's a very systematic campaign that's designed to bring maximum misery to the civilians of Syria.
Dr. Annie Sparrow, I thank you very much for taking the time to articulate what's going on. It's sounding beyond horrific, and congratulations on your advocacy too. Thank you.
Thank you, Natasha.
Dr. Annie Sparrow, she is an Australian paediatrician and humanitarian, professor of global health and director of the Human Rights Program at Icahn School of Medicine in New York. Annie will be speaking in Australia at the 4th Transcultural Mental Health and 2nd Refugee Health Conferences, which will be held in Perth later this month, October the 31st, I think they kick off. I want to let you know also this Sunday in an event where you'll see RN partnering with ABC local radio across the country and with UNHCR. We're going to conduct a special Syrian humanitarian appeal, and you can tune in wherever you are. Now, on Radio National, it'll kick off on Sunday from 2. Oh, I think it's right across the country, actually. I'm not sure, but I think it's Sunday at 2, 1 in Queensland and the Territory, and 11 in the West. So that's Sunday from 2, 1 in Queensland and the Territory, and 11 in the West. And we'll ask you to tune in. You'll hear from people like Annie on the ground, and we'll be inviting you to donate to the ABC's Syrian Appeal. More information about that and the range of organisations that you might like to consider donating to at abc.net.au/appeals. Well, on RN, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. It's Life Matters, and we're going to meet Anne Dowsett-Johnston next. She's written a remarkable book, Drink, The Intimate Relationship Between Women and Alcohol.